Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 19th of January. This hour of the program, we're going to be talking about President Obama's decision to impose a fee on the country's largest banks, insurance companies, and broker-dealers to recover some of the money spent bailing them out. The banking industry is evidently going to fight this. We'll also be looking at the much-reported-on bonuses that many executives will be receiving this year at very, very high rates, which has the public a little bit angry. We will talk about the move to move your money from big banks to small banks and look at what our guest calls an issue of fairness, that we need to really look at regulation of banks and we need to limit the size of financial institutions. It is basically an issue of fairness and banks have been reckless. Bob Landis is our guest. Bob is president of Landis & Company, which is a diversified investment firm with headquarters here in Milwaukee. He's the former co-host of Dollar Signs on PBS Channel 10 here in Milwaukee and spent 19 years at another radio station in this city, the same where I was for 18 years. He has degrees in economics, philosophy, and political science, a nice combination as we look at these issues, which of course are philosophical and political and economic. We'll be welcoming your phone calls. We haven't talked about this issue in quite a long time, so I know that our phones will be busy. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and our email address, which you can always use, is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Hello, Bob Landis. Nice to see you again.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Yeah, thanks very much for being with us. You say this whole issue about the size of banks, the bonuses, et cetera, is an issue of fairness, which means what?
Fundamentally, if you look back over the last 15 years or so, Kathleen, you realize that the large financial institutions realized they had nothing to lose by taking risk with other people's money. Go back to when long-term capital management, the hedge fund, went under. The perception at the time was that they almost brought the system down. The government's response was to bail them out and to rescue them. And after long-term capital management was rescued, the perception on Wall Street was that we have nothing to lose by taking a lot of risk. And we saw that time and time again with the government bailed them out. The expression back then was called the Greenspan put, the sense that at the time the federal chairman, the chairman of the Reserve Board, Alan Greenspan, would come to the rescue and bail out the financial institutions. So we talk about the financial crisis responsibility fee, or this new tax that the president wants to impose on the banks. And I think it's absolutely a step in the right direction, but it doesn't address the fundamental issue where we can't let financial institutions get so large where the government has to bail them out. Mm-hmm. So we have to address the fundamental cause of the problem, which simply is they got so big that we had to support them at the time of the financial crisis in the fall of 2008, or otherwise they would have brought the system down.
Mm-hmm. And so we need regulation in terms of this doesn't go far enough. We need to totally regulate the system in some way that we used to regulate them, or some way that's new.
Way back in 1933, they passed the Glass-Steagall Act that separated banks from securities dealers. They thought one of the reasons for the Great Depression in the early 30s was that the banks took excessive risk. They were underwriting securities, selling them to their own customers. So the Glass-Steagall Act, 1933, separated banks from securities dealers. Now, over the decades, the Glass-Steagall Act was slowly dismantled, and ultimately in 1999, they did away with Glass-Steagall. So one of the thoughts is to go back to Glass-Steagall and separate banks from securities broker-dealers. Perhaps a much more effective technique would be to limit the use of leverage with the financial institutions. Way back in the days of Ronald Reagan, the trend developed that fewer regulations were better for the economy. And I think many of us agree that, by and large, you want to let companies compete, particularly in a global environment. You want to allow U.S. institutions to compete around the world. So the thought over the years was the fewer the regulations, the better. Well, here's the problem, Kathleen. If what you do hurts you, have at it. But if what you do is going to hurt me, we're going to have to talk. It's not fair that your actions or those of the banks that I really mean, if they hurt me, that's not fair. I might not have benefited from their profit, but as a taxpayer, I'm being asked to pay for their bailout. And at a point in time now where the president is asking him to pay $9 billion a year, keep in mind that pre-tax profits at these 50 largest financial institutions are almost $190 billion.
Gee.
So to ask them to pay
peanuts.
It frankly is peanuts. But the bigger issue here is to make sure in the future through financial regulation that it doesn't happen again. The $9 billion is a drop in the bucket for all of the social cost that we're being asked to pay as a society. High unemployment, millions of families that are being dislocated because of foreclosures, and all of the other social problems that have developed during this financial crisis that the banks are directly responsible for, that has to ultimately be addressed.
They're fighting this now. They're saying that this is unconstitutional, or at least it looks like that's the direction they're going, that it's a tax on one particular industry and not others, that it affects banks who didn't even receive any money. What do you say to that?
Well, they did hire a very prominent attorney yesterday morning that was reported in the New York Times and the Washington Post. I read that a Harvard lawyer thought that they were wrong, that it is constitutional. There's nothing fair, in my opinion, about what the banks did. And in my opinion, the banks are going to need to be careful here, because this spring, when Congress debates financial regulation, there could be much more onerous penalties and fines put on the banks. So the thought is that they might have to compromise on this bank tax to make sure that they don't have bigger problems this spring in Congress.
What risks exactly did they take, Bob, with our money?
Well, start with leverage, Kathleen. You know, at most investment firms, you have something called Regulation T, where you have the right to borrow money against your account. At my firm, clients have the right to borrow up to 50% of their assets. No questions asked, I have to produce a check. Other investors figured out through hedge funds and private equity firms and the investment banks that they could leverage much more than just 50%. When Lehman Brothers went under, they were leveraged 29-1. When Bear Stearns went under, they were leveraged 31-1. Now, let's put this in perspective. If you have $1 million and you borrow $25 million, that's 25 million to 1, 25-1 leverage. If your account goes up 4%, you just doubled your $1 million. If your account goes down 4%, your million's gone. So there has to be limits on the use of leverage. That's going to be ultimately one of the only ways to make the banks behave themselves. There are all sorts of maneuvers over the years where bankers and investment bankers and private equity folks and the people that run hedge funds have gone around the regulations. And ultimately, there has to be a limit on the use of leverage. Dr. Rajan from the University of Chicago came up with a very clever idea of requiring firms to come out with bonds that have covenants that convert the bonds to equity in those banks when their capital structure is under duress. The point simply is, if most folks in the United States didn't benefit by the reckless lending, why are we being asked to pay for their rescue? So you force the owners of the companies to pay for the rescue. They're the ones that ought to bear the brunt of their recklessness, not you and I.
Mm-hmm. What happened for many of these large banks to be able to make a whole lot of money during the last year? I mean, we're looking at huge bonuses they're paying. They're obviously doing very well when they weren't doing very well just a couple of years ago when we had to bail them out. What have they done?
Well, look at the financial markets. In 2009, the S&P 500 with dividends reinvested was up over 26%. The Barclays Composite Bond Index was up 14% for the year. Pretty unusual, Kathleen, that bonds and stocks do really well in any given year. Usually if bonds do well, stocks aren't, and vice versa. So the financial markets recovering from the calamities of 2008 had a dramatic recovery. So in those times, equity dealers can trade their own accounts. They can leverage those accounts. And when the stock market goes up 26% and the bond market does incredibly well, you know, even modest uses of leverage will produce outsized profits.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that's happened that's made a lot of people pretty angry is the amount of money that they're giving in terms of bonuses to executives who, in some cases, created the calamity to begin with, and has a lot of people in this country saying, enough, we've had it, why are you doing this? Are you upset about those bonuses?
Well, you know, running an investment firm, I think it's critically important to attract talent. You have to pay for talent. So it's not the bonuses in and of themselves that upset me. It's the fact that the banks are not paying their fair share for the damage that they created since the fall of 2008. So to the extent that they properly repay you and I, the taxpayers, for the damage that they've caused. After that point, I think bonuses are appropriate. But to pay themselves these huge bonuses at a time when the government is struggling to keep the economy afloat, when the average person on the street is struggling to cover a mortgage payment, I think it's inappropriate. Bonuses, I think, are just part of the issue. You know, the bigger problem is we want to avoid this in the future. Changing the bonus structure like the British did, taxing bonuses above $40,000, I think is a step in the right direction, but it's not going to solve the problem of reckless use of leverage. The only way you're going to do that is by having higher capital requirements for these financial institutions so they can't leverage 25 to 30 to 1 or more and expect you and I to bail them out when things don't work out mm-hmm. so well.
And go back to those people who have been so hard hit, the people who have lost jobs, the people who have suffered sometimes divorce, the whole social problem that has developed, and a huge one it is, as a result of this recklessness. What are we doing? What can we do to help that segment of the American population?
Kathleen, you're right. It all boils down to jobs. Since November of 2007, we've lost 7.5 million jobs in the United States. Moreover, if you look at the underemployment rate, which, as you know, covers not just the people that are actively looking for work, but people that are working part-time and would prefer full-time employment, and then the people that have flat-out given up looking for work, the number is over 17%. That's the highest they've ever been able to record for the underemployment rate. They started designing that statistic back in the 1950s. So you have 17% of the U.S. workforce that's either given up or working part-time, would prefer full-time, or actively looking for work. Moreover, when they announced the unemployment numbers for December, we were then able to look back for the entire decade that just ended. The United States lost 1.5 million jobs in this last decade. We need almost 200,000 a month to keep up with population and immigration. So the result is the policies of deregulation were an utter failure. This concept of let's do away with all the rules, let people do whatever they want, had terrible consequences. And you want home values to recover? Put people back to work. You need a job most days to be able to buy a house. If you want consumer spending to increase employment. That's the only way you're going to be able to turn consumer spending around. You want to turn the overall economy around, you have to put people back to work. Kathleen, is getting worse, not better. 2 months ago, in a survey by the Wall Street Journal, the 55 leading economists that the paper polled thought that we'd have a net increase in employment for 2010. Just a couple of months later now, that's off the table. They now are suggesting that we're going to continue to lose jobs in the United States in the year 2010. Now, just to take a step back, in the normal procedure of things after a recession, the markets recover first, the economy recovers second, and employment recovers third. If you had a plant that manufactured pens, you're going to wait till you're just drop dead positive that business is better before you call back your third shift hire more workers. So it's typical in economic cycles for employment to recover after the markets have recovered, after the economy has recovered. But at this point in time, after 10 years of losing jobs in the United States, we have a long way to go before we're even able to keep up with population growth here in the United States. It all boils down to jobs, in my opinion, and the ability for the economy to increase employment is the only way we're going to solve
it. So we're talking about much more money in terms of stimulus from the government?
If you look at comments lately by Paul Krugman is one example. Princeton economist, he thought that the stimulus package was much too small. I suspect that members of the Obama administration would admit privately that that's the case. The thought back in December of 2008 was that they'd leave some money on the table in case they needed a second stimulus package. It's pretty obvious at this point in time that the stimulus package should have been larger. But at the time, you're trying to navigate through very turbulent waters, and it's easy to Monday morning quarterback what the administration did. But it's obvious. If you look at gross domestic product for the third quarter of this past year, if you strip away the benefit of the Cash for Clunkers program, if you strip away the $8,000 first-time home buyer's credit, it becomes pretty obvious that the economy was fairly weak in the third quarter, and that was the quarter where we pulled out of the recession. We'll know the numbers shortly for the fourth quarter. They think because of inventory rebuilds, the economy was a little bit stronger in the fourth quarter. But I suspect we're going to slip back into some fairly weak times with the economy because of the joblessness being so stubbornly high. Mm-hmm. Until that comes down, I don't see where the growth comes from.
Bob Landis, our guest. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. He's president of Landis & Company, a diversified investment firm that's headquartered here in Milwaukee. You may be quite familiar with Bob because he was on Dollar Signs on PBS Channel 10 here in Milwaukee for a number of years, and also was at another radio station in Milwaukee for 19 years. He is an economist, a philosopher, and a political scientist. His degrees are in all of those areas. We go to your phone calls, 800-486-8655. The overall area of discussion is the president's decision to impose a fee on the country's largest banks. We're also looking at bank bonuses for executives. We're looking at the state of the economy and related issues. So let's go to your phone calls. We start today with Frank from Madison. Hello, Frank.
Hello.
Hi.
How are you doing?
Fine, Frank. How are you?
Pretty good.
Good.
Excellent guest. I would like to make a comment, which is that the financial institutions in the United States effectively lobbied and had the conditions which were put in place after the 1929 crash removed. And this was supposedly because innovation gave more efficient markets, and risk could be properly evaluated and essentially went away. Now, it was known 100 years ago, almost exactly 100 years ago, as a result of the observation of what happened when financial panics occurred. There was a quite famous Scottish banker, Herbert MacLeod, who pointed out that the preconditions for financial panic, bank collapse, were an expansion of credit, the lack of internal controls, and the lack of external controls, that is, regulation. Those three conditions, he maintained, would inevitably lead to collapse. And he made that statement in 1909, he made it again in 1919, and the first regulations that began to regulate banking in 1923, and then finally after the major collapse in 1929, in 1934, were based upon those observations. You didn't have to be a sophisticated economist to understand. Now, the reforms, you know, capital requirements, internal and external controls, and restrictions on leverage and size were all reversed, and the world had not changed. And we've had a major collapse, which is going to pre-stage an even larger one, if we don't reform the banking system. And there's a major problem because the risk has been transferred to the public purse and the benefits to the bankers themselves, and they don't seem to have learned anything.
Bob.
Well, Frank, you're absolutely right. You know, when you look at the necessity of controlling the expansion of credit, internal controls, external controls, you know, Frank, think about the derivatives market over the last 10 years, where the big Wall Street firms designed products that were mind-numbingly complex to understand and almost impossible to regulate. And as a result of this push towards deregulation, it became almost impossible for anyone to really get their arms around the complexity of derivatives. Kathleen, you and I were talking briefly off the air about the nature of derivatives. Pretty easy to explain. They splice and dice securities into different packages. The concept of derivative just means that the value derives from some underlying value. So the concept of derivatives is easy to explain. Here's where the problem comes in. Understanding how they trade is not so easy. So some of the smartest people on Wall Street designed these complicated products, and over the last 10 years, they became very difficult to understand and almost impossible to regulate. Now, on top of that, as Frank pointed out clearly, that you've got to control the use of leverage so that we're not highly leveraging dangerous financial products that have this capability of blowing up on the system. It's interesting that Frank points out that we've known all this for almost 100 years. How curious is that? We've known for almost 100 years that you've got to control the expansion of credit. We've known for that long that you've got to have internal controls. You know, I was fascinated that John Mack, now the chairman of Morgan Stanley, admitted that the banks weren't capable of regulating themselves. How fascinating is that, that admission? So not only did we lack the internal controls at the banks, the investment banks and the hedge funds and the private equity firms, we didn't have the external controls. By their own admission, they weren't capable of regulating themselves. So we didn't even have the external controls that could have put a lid on this.
Always a pleasure to hear from you, Frank. Thanks for your call. We'll take more in a moment here on the Ideas Network. And we go back to your phone calls. Drew is next from Madison. Hi, Drew.
Hi, Mr. Linus. I've read reports of the Federal Reserve lowering the discount window rate about a year or year and a half ago so that the banks were able to borrow money from the Federal Reserve at absurdly low interest rates and then use that money to leverage their positions in the derivatives markets and the stock market. Are you able to give me a good estimate as to how much of their profits this year derived from borrowing our money?
Drew, when you take a look at the Fed lowering not only the discount rate, but the overnight rate, the federal funds rate, as it's commonly known, created all sorts of issues. And the one that we focus on right now is the fact that the Fed has provided all this money, but the banks aren't lending it out. Economists talk about the multiplier effect. Pretty simple concept to explain. If the Fed produces $1 million and it sits in somebody's bank vault, it doesn't do anybody any good. If a guy like you, Drew, borrows that $1 million, builds a business, you hire 12 people, your workers have to buy cars to get to work, you multiply that effect of that $1 million. Typically in the United States, a multiplier is about eightfold, meaning that $1 million that you're going to borrow, Drew, will create $8 million of economic benefit. Right now, the problem is the multiplier is a little bit under four. And the problem, in essence, is the Fed's producing this money, but the banks are reluctant to lend. They'll tell you that they can't find qualified borrowers. The qualified borrowers will tell you that the banks are less than willing to lend. And as a result, you know, we potentially will go down the road of the Japanese in the 90s, where they refer to it as the lost decade. The Japanese printed all sorts of money, but people didn't want to borrow anymore, and the banks didn't want to lend anymore, and low interest rates didn't do anybody any good. Now, Drew, back to your question, they lowered the discount rate, they lowered the federal funds rate. As you know, the target is between 0.25% to enable the banks to repair their balance sheets. That was a critical part of the process. To the extent that your question, how much money did they make by using that money from the Fed to invest for their own accounts? Well, the answer is plenty. In normal times, banks make approximately $190 billion of pre-tax profits in a year. And as we've seen this past year, J.P. Morgan Chase, you know, announced the other day that they had very high profits. And part of this is the nature of the beast with the rebounding of the financial markets. But the issue specifically, Drew, is you can wiggle one end of the string all you want, but you're not going to move the other end. The Fed can print all sorts of money, but if the money's going to sit in the bank vaults and if the banks are reluctant to lend, it's not going to do anybody any good. That was the experience that we saw with the Japanese in the 1990s. So the government has to figure out a way to pry the bankers' fingers off of the money sitting in the vaults and to multiply the effects of the money that's being printed. A lot of people worry about potential for inflation down the road. If the multiplier effect were still at 8, you betcha inflation would be a problem down the road. Right now, it's just the opposite effect that they printed all this money, but it's not in circulation.
Hmm. Anything else, Drew? Drew is gone. Thanks very much for your call. We have a couple lines open if you'd like to join us. 800-486-8655 is our number. The email you can send one of those to is talk@WPR.org. Let's switch for a moment to the people who are just getting by. Maybe they take $100 a month or $200 a month to put it in savings accounts, which are earning absolutely nothing, to put it in the money market, to put it in a certificate of deposit, all of those earning absolutely nothing. How is that being regulated, and is that is there some way for people to make more money on those kinds of accounts? What's going on with all that, Bob?
Well, Kathleen, this dovetails back to what Drew had asked. Bankers don't need your money. They can borrow for less from the Fed. There's no reason why they need to pay you 3%, 4%, or 5% on your savings accounts when they can borrow at the overnight window for less than 0.25%. So that's the crux of the problem. The bankers don't need your money. Loan demand continues to decline. The amount of money that they lend out continues to go down. And as a result, they don't need your deposits. They can borrow from the overnight window for a whole lot less than they need to pay you. And I think one of the points that need to be made for individual investors that are struggling with very low interest on their savings accounts, no interest on their checking accounts, is to make sure that you don't get lulled into complacency and you go out and buy bonds at a time when interest rates have nowhere to go but up. I mean, think not just cyclically, but in a secular way. 1980, Ronald Reagan, Paul Volcker, very famous lines. They needed to break the back of inflation. Paul Volcker was very concerned about creating a recession. Ronald Reagan said, "If not now, when? If not us, whom?" Very famous words. And, you know, they credit Ronald Reagan for really saving the country from runaway inflation. And the reason that I bring this up is for the last 30 years now, Kathleen, interest rates have been going down in the United States. So they peaked. The prime was at 20.5 in August of 1980. Now, we've had some bumps along the way, as you know. Bond market had a pretty good bump in 1994. But for the last 30 years, give or take, interest rates have been going down. We're now at a secular bottom of rates. And interest rates for the foreseeable future really have nowhere to go but up. So the problem that investors face is you really need to gut out low interest rates right now, knowing that over time, interest rates are going to gradually go up. We've been talking about the overnight rate, the federal funds rate. Economists expect the federal funds rate to end the year at about 1%. Now, the norm is 3, so we've got a ways to go yet. So by the end of the year, you'll see savings accounts start to creep up. When the banks have to pay 1% at the overnight window, they're going to be willing to pay you for your deposits more than they are now. So you got to give it some time, and you don't want to get locked in to low interest rates at a point where interest rates have nowhere to go but up. So my best advice is for investors just to gut out this period of time where rates are so low. Don't lock yourself into low interest rates. Gut it out. Stay with the low rates for now, and in the future, you'll see higher rates. Now, to answer the question you asked me, does that need some type of government regulation? I don't see how you do that. You know, they deliberately forced the overnight rate to almost zero to repair the balance sheets of the banks. Now, as that gradually occurs, the bankers are going to gradually be able to take more risk and start lending out more money. So I don't see how you regulate those short-term interest rates.
So you gut it out for how long, Bob?
Well, I think it depends upon your set of circumstances, you know, and unfortunately, the people that this really hurts are retirees, mm-hmm. people that are living off their life savings and now see that the interest rates have plunged. My guess is that over the next 2 to 3 years, you'll see interest rates dramatically higher than they are right now.
Okay. Bill is next. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I was wondering, my question is, the economy needs people to spend to grow and create more jobs. But people also need jobs in order to feel secure enough to spend. What in past recessions has spurred the recovery?
Bill, that's a great question. When you look at past recessions, there are a couple things that typically occur. One is people postpone purchases, and as the economy slowly recovers, people buy cars, they buy houses. And that pulls us out of the trough. From a technical standpoint, it's the inventory rebuilding process that normally pulls us out of recessions. You have a factory bill that makes pens. You read in the papers that the economy starts starting to slow down. So you slow down how many pens you make. And at some point in time, you start laying off workers, Bill, and you're selling inventory off the shelf. And that's typically one of the things that pushes us into recession is that you're not making as many pens. You're not selling as many pens, but the pens you are selling, you're pulling off the shelf. So, Bill, it's the opposite of that whole process that pulls us out of recessions. You realize that business is starting to improve. You realize that you have actually very few pens on your shelf to sell, that in anticipation of better times to come, you start replenishing your shelf with pens. And it's that process that pulls us out of recession. Now, here's the problem, Bill. The economists widely expect GDP to be almost 4% in the quarter that just ended a couple of weeks ago. A lot of that is on the heels of an inventory rebuilding process. The big unknown, of course, is will that be enough to pull us out of the downturn? Will that be enough to continue the process of economic recovery? And I'm not sure we know the answer to that yet, but it's typically inventory rebuilding that pulls us out of recessions. Bill, think of it another way. As you have read numerous times, 70% of our economy is consumer spending. Another 20% is business spending, and the remaining 10% is government spending. So if you look at the numbers, it's clear that you've got to have the consumer spending to turn things around again. The only thing that was temporarily available was government spending at a time when consumers were hunkering down. We saw the savings rate explode to over 7% last year, and businesses were reluctant to spend when times were tough. So, you know, the only option to turn the economy short-term was government spending, and most folks ought to thank their lucky stars that there was that stimulus package. No matter how unfair the package was, we did bail out the people that were responsible for the crises, but it was the only avenue open. So, Bill, the answer to your question is it's the inventory rebuilding process that normally pulls us out of recession, and we won't know for a while yet whether that'll be enough this time around.
Thanks, Bill, for your call. Rich from Sullivan. Hello, Rich.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Rich.
I wanted your guest to respond to this sort of claim on my part. I'm not a Marxist, but I believe that labor is the only thing that creates value, and no business person, no manager makes a profit unless labor is present in order to create value. We followed over the last many, many decades a systematic process of chasing the cheapest labor around the world, and we're told again and again, these jobs are never coming back. Well, I'm very sorry, but an awful lot of advanced economies did not do exactly what we have done. And we basically awakened a sleeping giant, communist China. And it's still a communist country. I think all those labels should say made in communist China, not made in China. But I don't want tariff wars, but don't we have to have a national policy where we say we keep jobs within our boundaries, or that we develop jobs within our boundaries in order for the American people to have family-sustaining work to maintain households?
Well, Rich, that's a can of worms. Let me try to address some of your issues. First of all, when you go back to the Great Depression in the 30s, one of the reasons for the downturn, as you probably know, is the creation of tariffs. You want free and open global trade. Now, along with open and global trade, you're going to have some consequences. But I'm clear on one point, which specifically is one of the causes of the Great Depression that started in 1929 was, in fact, that we started trade wars. So what you don't want to do is start creating barriers for free and open trade. As an economist, I can tell you that the only way we'll increase the aggregate net worth of people in Wisconsin is to allow people in Wisconsin to trade in other locations. If you have a closed society and you're only trading with one another, it's theoretically impossible to increase aggregate net worth. So the point, Rich, is if you want to increase aggregate net worth for folks here in Wisconsin, you've got to be able to allow them to trade outside of our borders. Now, the flip side is you've got to be willing to let people come in from other states and other countries and let them do business in the state of Wisconsin as well. And it's not the competition that I worry about. I think Americans are absolutely capable of competing with the Chinese, frankly, with any country around the world. When you look at the cost of labor, that's starting to change, meaning that I was fascinated by this story a while ago that we're now making coat hangers again in the United States after decades of
really
not making them because the cost of shipping them from China is now too high.
Huh.
So, you know, labor is just one piece of the puzzle, Rich. But when you take a look at, you know, the trends, I think it's going to be difficult to create jobs here in the United States, Rich. I think we need to do everything possible to create employment because it all starts there. But I don't think trade barriers are the answer because I worry about what happens when, you know, the Chinese start producing barriers of their own, and that could potentially lead to a decrease in economic activity, and then nobody wins that way.
Thanks, Rich. Lovely to hear from you as always. What do you think about this movement to take your money out of some of these big banks that have not been fair with us and put them in small community banks, credit unions, et cetera?
Well, Kathleen, I think that that's going to be a trend firmly established if the president gets his way and puts the $9 billion a year tax on the 50 largest financial institutions. Jamie Dimon of J.P. Morgan said not too long ago that, well, we'll just pass it on to the customer. Hey, not so easy, Jamie, when you've got community-based banks that are not subject to the tax, that are offering higher interest rates on their savings accounts. Why on earth would you keep your deposits at a large financial institution when they're paying less?
Yeah.
So they're not able to effectively pass on that tax. You know, I've always been fond of community-based banks. I've always been fond of, you know, knowing your lender, knowing the lender, knowing the borrower. You know, when I first came to Wisconsin, in 1974, most mortgages were generated locally and kept locally. You know, I knew of folks that were running a savings loan on the South Side, and when they made a mortgage, they checked your employer. You know, how's Tony doing? Is he going to keep his job for a while? They knew Tony. They knew his relatives. They knew his family. And they kept the mortgage. But when the bankers get paid for originating the mortgage and then they sell it off into the derivatives market, they wipe their hands of it. They have no responsibility moving forward to the nature of the loan. And that's where the problem started. Excuse me, where they weren't responsible for what ultimately happened to the mortgage. So I think there's a lot to be said for community-based banks. I think there's a lot to be said for smaller-sized thrifts that have skin in the game, if you will, and are willing to invest their capital reasonably and to get to the point in this country where we don't allow financial institutions to get so large where you and I are going to be bailing them out in the future. We don't benefit from them on the way up. Why are we paying for them on the way down?
Yeah, and they sure don't know you, and they sure don't know me, right?
Right.
Yeah. More phone calls for Bob in a moment. Here's our number, 800-486-8655. Bob Landis is our guest this hour. He is president of Landis & Company. which is a diversified investment firm with headquarters in Milwaukee, former co-host of Dollar Signs on PBS Channel 10 here in Milwaukee, and also spent 19 years doing a program at another radio station in this city. We have one line open. No, we don't. You can send email. I forgot about those. Hold on. Oh, we'll go to some of the emails, too. I'm sorry, everybody. We'll get to you momentarily. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And let's go to an email for you, Bob. Can you talk about similarities between this banking crisis and the savings and loan scandal of the 1980s? Did the taxpayers get a payback then? Can fractional banking work without government regulation? Thank you.
Well, if you go back to Resolution Trust Company formed in the late 80s to bail out the savings and loans, there are some striking similarities. One is that at the end of the day, when they shut down Resolution Trust, the government got their money back. Roll back the clock, 1986, the Tax Reform Act of 1986 did away with accelerated depreciation in real estate, changed the rules of the game, and created significant problems in commercial real estate around the United States and pretty much put an end to the reckless lending that had occurred. So by the late 1980s, we had a glut of commercial real estate in the United States. They formed Resolution Trust as a way to recover the assets. And the point that needs to be made is the government ultimately recovered the money that was invested in Resolution Trust Company. So come to the present now with the TARP money. The government has reduced their estimates by hundreds of billions of dollars as to what is going to be spent with the TARP money, and they're now well on their way to recovering much of that money. Relative to the other similarities, there's two things that Wall Street does really well: promotes fear and promotes greed. Wall Street's really good at it. And when you look at the 80s, very troubled times coming on the heels of what was at the time the worst recession since the Depression, that savings and loans seemed to be a license to print money. They started deregulating their rules and procedures, and as a result, were actively participating as real estate developers. And as we all know, that ended very badly. So tack on another 10 years to that whole process, and Wall Street decides that they're going to sell technology stocks. And that all ended badly. And then tack on another 10 years, and they decided that anybody with a pulse qualified for a mortgage, and that ended badly. So are we going to do away with the cycles of fear and greed? Of course not. Should we minimize the fallout? Yeah, of course we should. And my fear is, with this talk about the bank tax, is that we're not addressing the root problem, which is putting a lid on leverage, making sure that the people that really participate on the way up are participating on the way down. It's not fair that most of us who didn't benefit from the recklessness on Wall Street are being asked to pay to bail them out. So the tax is just a piece of the issue. Hopefully at some point in time, we'll be smart enough to elect politicians that will put a lid on this reckless behavior by the Wall Street firms.
Well, and this is, let's to draw on your philosophy background here too, Bob. It seems to me as though another of the root problems, obviously, is greed. And for the life of me, I don't get it. I don't know what people do with $20 million bonuses. I don't know how people can go to bed at night, without making that kind of money and thinking about what's going on in the poorest country in our hemisphere, in Haiti, and not go through some kind of process of self-examination. I don't want to get too philosophical about this, but what's going on with that? How can people live with themselves?
Go back to what Rich asked from Delafield, talking about how labor creates value. Boy, Rich, you're absolutely right. Well, think about how Wall Street gets paid. They get paid based on wealth. And it's a different concept, that you're not being paid for producing more pens per hour, as many workers are. You're being paid to increase wealth. And it's a completely different scale. And, Kathleen, where it's gotten really carried away is because of the excessive pay on Wall Street, it has now attracted many of the best and brightest from our nation's schools. So, you know, what's happening is, you know, the best and brightest are going to Wall Street. Larry Katz from Harvard did a study not too long ago, and he compared Harvard graduates that had the same degree, had the same demographics background, and the ones that went to Wall Street on average made three times what their other classmates made that didn't go to the street to make a living. So it's the excessive greed, in my opinion, but to a certain extent, greed is good. To a certain extent, you want people in the United States to take risks. You want someone to go to the bank to borrow money, to build a business and take chances and hire people and try to go for the Holy Grail. You know, that's the essence of capitalism. There is no better system. But what I object to is when excessive greed causes excessive leverage, where you can potentially take the system down and the rest of us have to pay for all that. That's not right.
Yeah. Drew from Madison. Hi. Drew, are you there? Drew is no longer there. We go to Scott from Green Bay. Hi, Scott.
Hi. I'm wondering if the excessive leverage on the part of the American is also at the heart of it. I'm just, this big economic calamity and this big collapse in the housing crisis, I'm wondering if it's a cultural thing with us that we want everything. We want, you know, we're a very consumeristic society. We want a bigger house. I mean, we leverage ourselves to the hilt. You know, you look at in a housing crisis where, and I know there's some banking issues behind it, but it still started with the guy taking out the loan that he really just couldn't afford. And I know that interest rates ticked up a little bit from the subprime, but if that little bit of an uptick caused you to default on your loan, you had a loan you shouldn't have ever even taken out. And I'm wondering if we as Americans really have to take some of the blame as opposed to always blaming the big shot bankers and the Wall Street guys. I mean, they're an easy target, but I think we bear some of the blame too.
Yeah, Scott, I think that's part of the issue, but it's nowhere near the issue. Scott, consider that the average American last year owed 131% of their income in debt, right? 131%. Now, that number is slowly coming down. People are gradually paying down their debt. Now, that number's doubled, Scott, over the last 25 years, doubled. So you're absolutely right, Scott, that the use of borrowed money has gotten all sorts of folks into trouble. But I'm going to ask you, if an uptick in interest rates cause someone to default on their mortgage, why was that loan even made in the first place? Where were the bank examiners? Where were the regulators? Where were the people that were running the bank? Why weren't they watching? It doesn't make sense, Scott, that those types of loans were made on the books. I know of a story in South Florida where one of the biggest banks in the country was refinancing a person's home, and the husband had just lost his job. And the banker told the wife, well, that's only on paper. We're going to go ahead and not only refinance, but we're going to extend additional credit to this family. It's only on paper. What do you mean it's only on paper, right? Yeah, so there are all sorts of examples of that. But to get to the essence of your question, Scott, there's no question that Americans increased their use of debt over the last 25 years. It effectively doubled. But that's not the leverage that brought the system down. When you think in terms of 132% of your income, that can't hold a candle to 25-to-30-to-1 leverage that was being used by the biggest banks. That's what almost brought the system down.
Sue has an email. Are we in danger of the double whammy, and I'm not even sure what this means, so explain it to me, of stagflation?
Sue, I think there's always the concern that stagflation could come down the pike. When we look at inflation, there are a couple of things that have to happen. One is unemployment's got to come way down below 10%. Number two, we talk about capacity utilization, simple concept to explain the amount of plant and equipment that's currently being used in the United States. Historically, inflation is created at 82% when we create bottlenecks. Capacity utilization is very low now. Last summer, it fell to the lowest since they started keeping records on this in the 50s. Thirdly, we talked about the multiplier effect of money. If the multiplier was at 8 right now, you bet inflation would be coming down the road. So you look at the fundamental fundamentals of what typically causes inflation to go up, they just don't exist right now. Relative to the stag part of stagflation, well, I think we're there. We've got an economy that's been growing anemically. This concept that you'll hear more and more about this year of the new normal, that the economy has been permanently reset at a lower level and we're going to grow at anemic rates of growth from here for the foreseeable future. I think that's a given.
We have 1 minute left. I want to take this call, but just let everybody know our time constraints. Greg is next. Hi, Greg.
Hi. I'm just calling you to say that I don't really think that I believe, just like Mr. Landis does, that, you know, capitalism is the best system. But we also have to have some values that there, and you got to balance off the greed. So we need regulation of these institutions. And hey, if they're too big to fail, they're too big to have. And that's one of the questions, or make them underwrite their own risks so that we don't publicize, you know, we don't socialize all the risk and all the gravy goes to the bankers. But just like in the healthcare debate.
10 seconds.
Just like in the healthcare debate, what we've got is we've got lobbyists working like crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
let's just get a brief response from Bob. Influence of lobbyists on this.
Well, I mean, that's absolutely a problem. The banking lobby is one of the strongest in the country. And, you know, they're already starting to complain and meow about the tax now on the banks. My guess is it's going to be a tough row to hoe this spring when Congress wrestles with financial regulation.
Thank you, Bob. It's great to hear you on the radio again. I love the combination because you bring everything to bear on this political thought, philosophic and economic. Thank you. Bob Landis, our guest, president of Landis & Company, diversified investment firm with headquarters here in Milwaukee, former co-host of Dollar Signs on PBS. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production here in Milwaukee. News is coming up, and we'll return for another hour of conversation.